Now on RT Radio 1, Arts Tonight, presented by Vincent Woods.
In progress, Galway's new Picture Palace Cinema and the politics of the visual with Rod Stoneman. Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight. The history of film and cinema in Galway and the West is part of an unfolding story from the days of the first film society in UCG in the early 60s through the renaissance of film in the 70s and 80s, the work of Bob Quinn, Joe Comfort, Lelia Doolin and Patsy Murphy, the setting up of the John Huston Film School and the now famous Galway Film Fla, the journey is now at a point where Galway is seeking the status of UNESCO City of Film. And after many years of dedicated dreaming and hard work, Galway is finally getting a dedicated art cinema, the Picture Palace, which will open next summer. Right at the edge and the centre of things, close to the Spanish Arch, the so-called Latin Quarter and Druids McLally Theatre, the Picture Palace is emerging like a piece of sculpture destined to become a landmark building in Galway's cultural life. We visited the new cinema recently with Lelia Doolin, who has been a driving force behind it, Tracy Geraghty, project manager, and Tom Dupuyer, the architect who has transformed a small corner of the West. This is the Picture Palace in the making.
This site is built, this cinema is built in a house and a garden, just in a downtown,
right in the heart of Galway.
Yes, absolutely. It's just so nice to be here because you have a feeling for all of the people around, all the businesses around, all the people coming and going, the museum across the road. All of that is just so nice. And the building itself is intended to be a very convivial, public, open space for people.
When did you first dream a new cinema for Galway?
Well, I wasn't the only one, my God. There were a couple of people. When I was in the film board, we began thinking about it. And then, I think it was 2003, the Arts Council did a study looking at cultural cinema all around and decided that they would put up some money for people to make cinemas or to refurbish places. And this happened to be one of them. So in 2003, Tracy Geraghty and Paddy Hayes and Anna, who worked in the film board, said to me, why don't we do something about this? So forgot about it for a bit and then suddenly thought, yes, come on. So we very quickly put together a request both to the Arts Council and after that then to Access 2. John O'Donoghue, who was the minister. We looked for 4 million. He gave us 2 million and the Arts Council gave us 750,000. Anyway, don't want to go into too many details, but in effect it meant that we could make a start. And we just kept going, kept raising money, kept talking about it, kept talking to Tom. Tom Dupuyer is the genius architect and Anna Hofheinz is the project architect. Both of them absolutely wonderful. And we started to build it with the local builders, Cordell, in 2010. And then we came a cropper because recessionary times hit. And there was, you know, a sad series of events which resulted in their being, you know, going into liquidation and the site being, in effect, closed down for quite a while. So we just had to start again. Actually, I'm wrong. It started in 2009. We were fully funded, in effect. In the interim, because of what had been happening, we were short of money. So anyway, we went to tender again and we finally agreed with Pádraig Gratigan, local builders. And it cost more and we had less, so we've spent quite a lot of time
begging
and getting things together, and little by little we've managed to keep our nerve. And fortunately the city, who were the first actually on board to buy the site for us, Galway City Council, brilliant, meant that we were just able to inch forward, and we kept inching forward, and here we are now, very near the point where finishing and fixing and fit out and completion and opening look to be possible.
I presume there's a great deal of excitement in Galway around the idea of this new cinema. And I imagine as well that the fact of the John Huston Film School being here and T.G. Cahir, you know, beside us as well, it adds impetus to all the possibilities around this.
Yes. You see, Galway is in effect the new capital of film in the West. It is, well, the new capital of film, I would say, in Ireland. We have decided about a year ago to look for the status of UNESCO City of Film for Galway. Given that the Film Board, a national support agency, is here, that TJ Cahir is here, the Telegael is here doing Rusna Roon and all of those, O Telefiche doing all of those, you know, important television things, and that there are over 50 production companies sited in and around the area, that there's a television service in the English language, even RTE, one might even say that. And there is simply a great deal of energetic creativity around, both on the production side. But what wasn't available to the citizens of Galway, apart from the Galway Film Society, now entering its 50th year, by the way, amazing, amazing people, two of whom are on our board, Bridie and Joe McMahon, they sort of... The people here look on the papers, I think, on a weekend and see what's around in Dublin and think, why are we not able to have all of that? And that's been part of this dream, is to give people in the west of the Shannon more than Cromwell gave them, and to enable a sort of, a celebratory and enjoyable going out possibility for popular consumption, to be able for people to be able, for you can edit that furiously, to the people of Galway. Whether people are excited or not, I hope that they will simply be pleased and delighted and able to go out and have a great evening. I mean, there's a cafe, there's a bar, there are three screens, which one of which is also going to be a performance area at the top cinema, and that I think will give us an opportunity to broaden out the educational and entertainment and enjoyment possibilities, because I do think, with, as you say, the GMIT and the Houston School of Film, there are lots of young people now who are beginning to make film and who want to see them exhibited. And the Irish film activity, you know, through the years now has begun to really burgeon. Wonderful, beautiful films being made. Great enjoyment. And the fact of the matter is, you know, we need nurturing. We need nurturing through all the possibilities of human experience and storytelling that film enables people to enjoy.
Do you ever think about showing your films at the hall?
What do you mean?
Well, put them on a double bill with a good western.
It will be a cowboy film.
Shut up! All I know is that the place is in sore need of stewardship.
St. Patrick would have had a hard time with you.
St. Patrick wasn't trying to sneak in Hollywood filth.
And I think of a film like Thaddeus O'Sullivan's Stella Days and the incorporation of cinema itself, of the physical building and of cinema into film, into the making of film. And I can imagine actually that in the future a building like this could become part of a film set in Galway.
Well, who knows? Absolutely. It is, in a way, a kind of a film set with all the wonderful staircases going everywhere and the windows, which I have to say, one of the beauties of the building, apart from its being such a ladylike place in a sense, it's all poured, you know. All the entire building has been poured. It's
all the concrete poured.
The concrete poured in negative and allowed to set and settle. Wonderful team of 9 men who really were the start of the whole thing. And now that it's here, you can see through the windows the genius of Patrick Scott. And these are kind of not exactly stained glass, but resin, beautiful artworks that people can see out of in the daytime and see from outside, winking into the night, I hope, as they go by.
It's a beauty. I mean, the colours are so beautiful in those windows. I think they're going to add so much to all the possibilities of this. And I want to just have a look at one particular feature over here as well, incorporated into it. You're saying that every palace needs a lady.
Yes. There was in Clarendon Bridge, in the porch of the church, long ago. I live out on that side of Galway, and I saw this bas-relief of, I think it must be the only figure of a Madonna standing on a crescent moon, and it's just sitting there. Some wonderful old medieval sculptor made her, and so we asked the parish priest if he would be agreeable to making a cast of it, which he did, And we have now incorporated her into the building. So
it's beautiful because we look out through this Patrick Scott window, this beautiful, these squares of pink and kind of pale red and these kind of luminous qualities from the colour in this, through a square at Our Lady.
Yes.
And
yes.
It's a really, really beautiful detail.
Yes, there's a whole question, that's the great thing about argument, whether or not she is the figure of the Mother of Christ or whether in fact she is an avenging angel from the Book of Revelation.
So could be there both, are, I
yes,
suppose.
Exactly. So I think that's there's a nice ambiguity to her. And she's so gorgeous. I mean, just to look at her, you think, ah, that's right. Every palace needs a queen.
For some reason, I think of films again like Cinema Paradiso and
yeah. Well, it's just you know the Cinemobile is the great traveling cinema that we is going around the country and allowing places like the one where Stella Days happened to see cinema again.
In Tipperary, right through Leitrim, the big mobile cinema in Leitrim. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, the fact is that. If you look at the history of cinema going in Ireland, everybody in small villages and towns had an opportunity to go to the cinema in the old days. There was some building somewhere handy. And now that's gone because all of those families probably just couldn't sustain those places. So that was one of the reasons why we tried to get the Cinemobile together. And now there are two. There's the National Cinemobile, Fiche na Mbailte, and there's Cinema Northwest, which Leitrim has been keeping going and is hopefully now going to cross the border as well quite a lot. So all of that engagement and opportunity for people to enjoy their lives, to have increments of enjoyment in tough enough times seems to me to be what we ought to be about.
And I think that cinema again will feature as a motif, as an image in the new Ken Loach film in Jimmy's Hall.
Yes.
In Leitrim. And again, looking at that, the impact of early cinema, I suppose, around a political event. There's a great tradition of cinema architecture in Ireland that we forget about at times. And, I remember the Gaiety in Carrick and Shannon, but then there's a lovely film, The Uncle Jack.
John T. Davis.
John T. Davis about his uncle,
McBride
Neal, who was one of the great architects of cinema.
Absolutely, and that is a wonderful film. And I think it's a kind of a history of social life in Ireland, in that you get a feeling for not just what people were doing in their work day, but what they were doing in their evenings or what they were going out to see, and how people who were architects and creators of things responded to the kind of popular need, because people have been saying to us, of course, remember, this is a business, it is not just an art form. And of course, we have to keep remembering, and we do remember that. We're here in the middle of Galway, in among small businesses, a museum, the old Spanish arch, restaurants, cafes, all of those kinds of places which make a convivial atmosphere alive in a town. I mean, what makes a town? It's the comings and goings and gatherings and meetings of people. And that's what this place, as I think as a public facility, is going to be. And I well remember the early days of the Claddagh Palace, or the days when we took it over to do the film fly there. I suppose the kind of energies in a town like this were always abundantly evident with Druid, with the Arts Festival, with then the FLA, and with the emergence of schools of film, with the film centres, which allowed young people to have access to recording and cinema, cameras and all of that. And I suppose, in effect, it's been a slow, incremental pathway in which then the arrival of the Film Board, the continuation of the Film Society, all of those things have responded to what people wanted to do. If you consider, that from just a bunch of people in a university, there's now an international theatre. When you consider that the Arts Festival is probably one of the great festivals, that the FLA is a big international event every year. The whole of July in Galway, in effect, is given over.
Yeah,
and this small cinema now, it seems to me, can be a meeting place for a lot of those festivals, for short film festivals, for screenings for people who want to look at what their films have been doing, how, you know, rushes can be screened, educational events can be held for young people particularly. I mean, the whole idea of enjoying a film can get an added impetus from having an opportunity to see it with others and hear a bit about it. So all of those seem to me to be the ways that Galway has responded to and created, and this simply is a place for all of that to continue happening and perhaps grow, and new adjuncts, new opportunities, new ideas.
Tracy Geraghty, you're project manager on the cinema here, on the Picture Palace. How did you, and how do you go about ensuring that a concept for a building turns into, I suppose, a really efficient working cinema?
At every stage of design and tender, I'd look at it in terms of how do you move people into the building, how will people use that space within the building, and then just our own experiences of cinemas and cinemas that we've loved, cinemas that we've enjoyed, because we've all grown up with cinemas. You know, it was probably for most people the first cultural, avenue they ever explored. Mine was the Ambassador on the top of O'Connell Street, and the sense of grandeur, and that's what we wanted. We wanted something that had a sense of grandeur, a sense of excitement, and so that the cinemas would be these beautiful rooms and not really the modern interpretation of how cinemas have developed.
Multiplex cinemas become really anonymous and they all seem pretty much the same.
Well, they're not special. It's not a special event anymore. The buildings aren't special events. They're more utilitarian and about moving people in and moving people out, whereas the Picture Palace was about creating a space that people had a real personal connection to, which was always what they had in the past. So to try and regain some of that.
And again, I suppose the idea of three cinema spaces obviously allows for the possibility of showing films simultaneously, of having again a diversity of events going on within the building.
In terms of economic viability, I mean, if you look at the European, CineTech model, you absolutely need three cinemas to, the IFI obviously expanded to a third screen about 18 months ago. You need to be able to move your films as they become, as the audience numbers and you would hope to have in three screens that you'd have 15 to 16 titles a week, that you'd show. Some films you may only show once, so that there's always, people always want to see little things, and you have a different audience come out on a Tuesday night to the audience that comes out on a Saturday night, and so that you would cater for all of your audiences.
I love the idea as well of the building incorporating a tea room.
Yes. Well, I'm very fond of cake, and so all tea and cake eating opportunities are to be welcome. And again, it's a very pleasant experience. You come in, you have a bite to eat if during the day, and you go to see a film, or you come in and that the cinema space is not just about film; it's about a civic building that has a relationship with the people of the town. It's people use it to meet up with friends. We saw a cinema space in London, and various community and groups used it as their meeting point. We would like for that, there was potholers and knitting groups and all sorts of stuff. We would like to see that the bar and the cafe have that sort of, that people feel that level of association with them, that it's their space. It's not just our space. It's the community. It's Galway space.
Lily, I presume it would be amazing for Galway to get UNESCO City of Film.
I think it would be only proper, to be honest with you. Everything that is in Galway, almost everything that we know about and have anything to do with, has to do with film, has to do with the making, with the looking at, with the analysing, with the enjoyment, with the creation of film. And so between I was telling the amount of money, I think somewhere I have a document which I'll give you can read out, which shows what actually accrues to the
To the local
economy,
economy
from film making, and hopefully we'll add to that. So, I think film is absolutely the heart of everything nowadays. It's a popular medium. You know, you don't have to dress up, though it's nice if you do, and people do, as we all know. You can relax. It's a very relaxed medium in which people can actually see other lives, other cultures, other worlds, other stories in the most wonderfully engaging way. I mean, it's just the heart of everything. And it incorporates every one of the arts, music, dance, vision, you know, literature, the whole gamut. It's the best possible thing in the whole universe.
I'm Connor Hogan and I'm studying screenwriting.
My name's Patter Clancy and I'm studying screenwriting too.
I'm Danny McCafferty and I'm a screenwriter.
I always had problems myself trying to write screenplays. I'd always get to maybe the 20 or 30 page mark and I'd run out of steam. But I think one of the main reasons doing this course, I really needed kind of like the structure and discipline element of it. And I think I'm greatly enjoying it so far, and I think it's definitely going to helping my writing, and I think it'll definitely make me a better writer.
I finished last year, so I've finished scripts and I've done my scripts and I'm out trying to get them commissioned or whatever you like at this stage, trying to sell them, you know. But I'm part of a writer's group as well, and I think you got to go it alone and got to write them alone, but it's good to hand it over and get the feedback, and our couple of people coming back saying the same thing, you got a problem, if everybody's saying something different. Or actually the good thing about it in a room is when actually debate starts up and people start arguing, well no, I thought that was all right, and then you go, right, okay, you're onto something then, if that's happening in the room, really, you know.
I think some of the best writing is in television now. I think when writing The Wire, they were talking about it as the idea of the new version of the giant Russian novel, because you can have the continuing story and have a much longer length and detail than you can do in a feature-length film or even a film series.
Templeware architect on this picture palace, when did you first come on board?
Must be nearly 10 years when the idea was mooted that there would be an art house cinema in Galway, and then we went kind of dragged through various hedges trying to find
a suitable site.
Find a place in town that you could afford, or a developer who would be sympathetic, until ultimately this corner house was found and bought, which is a brilliant location, really, in that it's, you know, it straddles the old town and the docks, and you know, it's kind of important as an urban building, I think, in terms of how Galway can connect itself and expand its centre and so on.
And it was originally a small enough house with a garden, I think.
Yeah, it's a 1820s. There's a house and the house next door. So maybe a modest house with a return and a small back garden, and so the building then kind of creeps out over the street a little bit to gain a bit of few seats, and creeps under the pavement a little bit downstairs. But essentially, yeah, it's a house. It's still a house. I think it's a house anyway. The dimensions feel absolutely
quite intimate in a way.
Yeah.
It's still a lovely feeling, both of space and of something small enough to feel like it belongs to you.
I hope so, yeah. I mean, this staircase is, we always thought this is the front stairs, you know, and it was meant to it had to have a kind of domestic scale, because of, you know, the driver was essentially to maximise the number of good cinema seats, and that makes the difference in an institution like this, how it works or not. So after that, then, packaging all the, what's effectively all staircases then, between fire staircases, and to squeeze those in and around and between the served spaces, if you like, was the game. And it's all very domestic. They're all just about, you know, they're on regulations, but they're kind of it's intimate, and it unfurls against that, so that when you get into the main bodies, the main rooms, they feel very big. And then it's gnarly like Galway and complex, and you go in from behind things and around things, so it has that kind of sense of, hopefully there's no signage that somebody shows you round the first time, and after that you know it, you know.
What were the biggest challenges in terms of coming up with a concept for a cinema as opposed to any other building you might design?
Well, I was brought to see some very good cinemas in Europe, old ones actually, kind of they were part of the kind of grand tradition, the 20th century tradition of cinema. So we went from, you know, what were originally small theatres that then became used as cinemas, so that kind of music hall thing, to maybe more deco palaces of the 30s and 40s, to some very contemporary ones. So the idea of it being a, you know, okay, you have well-tempered rooms that you can show movies in, but also that it's a public house, and that it's decorated, and that it has pleasure, and that it has a name, and that it, you know, it's slightly deluxe, even in a Spartan way. It was all kind of part of the game, and that's what Tracy and Lelia were at, you know, and the windows are eyes, etc., etc., etc. So the brief kind of came through the description of the thing, you know, standing in somewhere in Rotterdam going, I love neon, don't you, in a car park. You go, yeah, I really do. So what's it going to say? It's going to say palace. So then you've got to do it, don't you? It's like that.
Let's go out and look at the name, at the lettering on the outside.
You see, that's funny, because that's the air intake for the cinema below.
So the lettering goes right through.
It's a sharp intake of breath.
Because what's the depth there, the depth of the concrete?
That's about 300 mil, so it's cast right through it.
So you get P-A-L-A-S right through that depth.
And then the two fathers are windows to the stairs above, so they're like lancet windows in a castle. So, I mean, it's just about enjoying that, you know, and I think that's a tradition that that was worth, again, kind of making the thing
but it's familiar. Playful, as well,
and
functional. I mean, it's a lovely combination of a feeling of something quite, you know, the lettering is really elegant.
And really hard to do an S in concrete.
Tell me about, Tracy was mentioning that this the concrete, that this being done in negative. What does that mean in terms of the final surface you get and how it's done?
Well, the building is entirely concrete. So what you're really looking at is, although maybe there's four stories below, normal domestic stories, you're looking at an eight-story concrete building that the guys were pouring concrete for a year and a quarter. And so what you do is you build the thing in negative, and then you cast it. Like, so it's a completely handmade thing in a way. And it means that, like, the team were really brilliant. It means that you have to be very clever in three dimensions to actually just get your head around, and because the thing has quite complex geometries and parts of it, to try and get that all to tie in and add up within tolerances of about 10 millimetres. It's quite pretty tricky. And then, of course, because the staircases are unheated, it means that the concrete is exposed on the inside. The only rooms that are lined or dressed are the cinemas and the bar and the cafe. So the inside... It's the inside of the outside, if you know what I mean. And it means that that's finished work on the day it's struck, other than that you might polish it. So it doesn't have the normal tolerances of, you know, you build a block wall, you plaster it, you dress it. None of that
happens.
You're
looking at finishing a surface in several dimensions.
Yeah, and you have to, you
have to get it right for a start.
You have to get it right, or you have to sort of accept sometimes what you're given, or adjust it, and that's kind of part of the rough and tumble of these things as well. A bit like, you know, a bit like Boland's Mills or something. You know, those big silos on the edge of town, they just have this kind of big brooding presence. And then, of course, it demands that you have sweet parts as well, such as the windows or the, you know, the handrails and so on. That they're very crafted and soft, so that the thing kind of has a sweet and sour sort of pleasure in its experience, and that means then that you're left with just pure space, because the inside is that of the outside. The resultant is just space, which you don't get very often in buildings. You get lots of lining, you get lots of additive construction, but you often lose the space. And I think that's where the small dramas are in this building, is its spatial qualities.
Tom, I presume as well that another challenge for here was the fact that cinema is in Galway, and here, if you like, almost be on the edge of right beside the docks, of what is now the kind of established more or less as the cultural quarter of Galway, the Latin Quarter, and it's a very specific location beside the Spanish Arch. So it's in a way it's this meeting point of kind of old and modern and the sea and land, and I presume that Galway and its location within Galway really must have been key to what you were coming up with as well.
This is a great site, a difficult site, but a great site. I mean, there's no pleasure in going into a black box on the edge of town. You'd rather wrangle harder, and you know, to make this happen and to contribute to what's happening. You know, support the museum, support what's happening in the docks. Make a landscape, a landmark building in the proper sense of the word, that can kind of make the town pivot a little bit and draw people up from Shop Street. I mean, that was what cutting the view to the Corrib was about, as well as kind of locating it back and kind of grabbing a little bit of that action. And also I think holding, which was insisted upon and made things more difficult, but ultimately was the right decision, to holding the, I don't know what it is. I don't know what its truth is now. But holding the old building or the corner of Merchant's Road kind of holds that whole piece of fabric together, higgledy-piggledy as it is, and that's what we need. You know, that's what it's those bits of stuff, those bits of townscape. I think that's very important, and I like it's making that argument, and I like that you come under the old arch. Pardon me, but for that, then it becomes quite complex. In the way that Galway is, actually, although it's small, it's very, very complex, you know, morphology. And I kind of thought it was part of that, and I thought it was part of trying to figure out, could you make a Galway-esque building? Is there a Galway building?
Music, of course, from The Quiet Man. And at the beginning of the programme, you heard music from Cinema Paradiso. In a moment, Rod Stoneman on his book, Seeing is Believing. Tonight we're looking at cinema and film, and from a cinema in the making to a book made. Seeing is Believing, The Politics of the Visual is the title of a new book by Rod Stoneman, director of the Houston School of Film and Digital Media at NUI Galway and former chief executive of the Irish Film Board. He's also a former deputy commissioning editor at Channel 4 Television and has made a number of documentaries. Seeing is Believing is a fascinating mix of short texts, reflections, analysis and semi-autobiographical observation, matched and illuminated by hundreds of images, photos, film stills, ads, paintings and cartoons. It may have been inspired in part by John Berger's celebrated Ways of Seeing, but this book goes deep into the realm of today's digital media culture, with all its possibilities, good, bad and ambiguous. Rod Stoneman, this book, Seeing is Believing, feels and reads like something of a lifetime's accumulation of knowledge and observation. Tell me about how you came to write it, or perhaps more accurately, to draw it all together.
Well, in 2009, I had some space from the normal teaching semester, and I'd wanted to do a book on cinema stills, but gradually that became, I was fascinated to just take images from different parts of culture and politics. And as I began to dig around them, to maybe I'm being naive, but to my own surprise, I found that nearly every image had a more complex history, which indicated that the first encounter, the first read one had with it was false, that I gradually began to have a sense of a kind of image system which is based on delusion, which enables us to live and understand things in a certain way, and I think there's a political as well as an aesthetic dimension to that, which actually, if we stopped and thought more, begins to unravel.
Unraveling of image. I often think about John Berger's book Ways of Seeing, which was something of a revelation to me in the late 70s. His book that, as well, helped to challenge how we see and read images and showed as well how images can be manipulated for commercial and political ends. One critic said that your book may be a kind of Ways of Seeing for our time. Is that a comparison you'd be happy with?
Well, frankly, modesty permits, it's a very flattering comparison because, like you, Berger's Ways of Seeing was incredibly important and influential when I was a student in the late 70s. And I remember the section on advertising and the images of women in advertising, which was, you know, like a kind of epiphany. And maybe it's a bit more academic and obscure, but he also talked about the history of art in an entirely different way. And so when I think it's Mr. and Mrs. Andrews are there in a Gainsborough picture with their dog and their shotgun and their land, he brought a Marxist analysis to bear and said, well, that is about possession and control, not just landscape and portraiture.
Before that, before Berger, before your own studies, how did your interest in the visual develop? I mean, were you a child who consciously looked at things? I mean, are there images you remember from very early on?
Growing up in Devon in southwest England, I suppose there's a very rich visual environment and, you know, by the sea and the edge of the Dartmoor in the countryside. But gradually, I got interested in a wide range of arts and, in fact, did English literature at university. But that was gradually edged aside by film and maybe aspects of the visual arts.
Five main sections in the book: history, politics, arts, culture, film, television, products, possessions, and the quotidian, the strange. And they break down then into themes like war, family, artisan poets, music video, language of fashion, street life, and so on. Did those themes and threads emerge naturally in the writing and thinking, or did you set out to explore those particular categories?
They emerged, and frankly, they're a little bit blurred and overlapping at the edge. It was a way of putting a shape on a very fragmentary set of inquiries. I mean, they're not completely arbitrary categories, but, talking about the manipulation of an image of a cormorant killed by oil in the first Gulf War is in history and politics, where it could perfectly well be in film and television. So there's a lot of movement between the categories, but they go through, importantly for me, the last category is about the way out or the future or the way that street art and graffiti is used by younger generations to have a direct and active relationship with imagery rather than being passive consumers.
The many images of war and its aftermath remain shocking. The images in the book, you know, remain haunting, remain shocking. And it's almost hard to take in the enormity of human cruelty and the suffering in images like the bodies piled up at Buchenwald or at the Paris Commune after the massacres of 1871. I suppose one would like to think that such images would help to prevent their repetition. I wonder if they ever have or if they do.
I think, sad to say, hardly at all and hardly ever. I don't want to, as one gets closer to the end of life than the beginning of it, I don't want to descend into some, intellectual pessimism. But this very... we all remember when we first saw pictures of the camps. I think, you know, somewhere in our adolescence, hopefully not too early in life. But I don't know that the revelations of Nazi industrialized genocide has had any effect on anything, which I call that section Never Again, again, because clearly, 1945 was not the most recent. There's a section on ecology where, trying to be honest about my own lack of cognizance of a rather important Horizon documentary actually shown in, I think, 70 or 71, called Tomorrow Has Been Cancelled Due to Lack of Interest. It was a BBC documentary which basically said the planet is in grave danger. And there was an American scientist, I remember his phrase, maybe man, this is the end of the documentary, showing a whole series of ecological problems, to put it mildly. The scientist said, maybe man is like a dinosaur shot in the back brain, already dead, but he doesn't know it. And I remember that sentence, but that's all. I mean, it's only the last 5, maybe 10 years that ecology has properly been on the agenda. I mean, now in 2013, there's a sort of belated degree of seriousness, although even so, there are governmental and corporate motives, clearly, to disavow and to bury it still. And I suppose that BBC programme is the example of an image which had little effect on me.
There's so much in the book. I mean, in a way, it's impossible to do justice to the range and diversity of it. And again, I should say it's primarily international in its focus. But one section that seems particularly relevant to this country now is the currency of time, where you look at the image and presence of money in society. And there's James Joyce on the Irish 10-punt banknote of the early 1990s. Do we remember it? And then the bland, generic notescapes of the euro. And that imaging of money is fascinating. And of course, it's potentially receding into electronics and plastic cards. And that's, again, it's very, very interesting to think of that, of where image may almost disappear and what it can say, even about the aspiration of a society.
Well, I remember in, I think it was, the autumn of 1993, when I was leaving London, I was working in Channel 4, and I remember saying at my goodbye party in that television station something about, well, I'm not fully familiar with the culture and the country that I'm going to work in, but any country which has the most avant-garde novel of the 20th century on its banknote must have something to recommend it. Britain continues, like most other non-Euro countries, I suppose, to have scientists and bankers on their notes. And that's emblematic for me. The question of, I mean, I've had a relatively, privileged, gilded career and never been short of money. But I'm aware of the way in which for nearly everyone in nearly every way, money is such a central part of our striving. And I wonder if that is the best way for us all to spend our time. I wonder if it's mad or utopian to think of, I can hardly say this, working less and being paid less, having more time to do other things. Is that completely crazy?
The currency of time. Of course it's not.
Indeed.
how do we image it and imagine it? You mentioned Berger and the section in his book on women and advertising and the use of women, the sexual images of women in advertising. And your own section on sexual imagery and powers is also very interesting. This, again, women as objects, the world of porn, I found this fascinating, alive and well, just beneath the radar at the Cannes Film Festival. And again, the ambiguity was of Sheila na Gig images, stone images here in Ireland. As well as flesh and sex sell, film and magazines and cars and God knows what. Do we, at the end of the day, do we have to accept that that's the way the world is and there's little we can do to change it?
Well, even if it's a difficult and uphill struggle, to put it mildly, I don't think we have any option but to try to change it. I think that all of us in our different ways have to work to challenge and change. I mean, the question of sexuality, it's probably easier to do it without images and talk on the radio, but the question of sexuality somehow manages to survive in its power and pleasure and energy, despite a very aggressively commercialized image system which uses sexuality in the way you indicate it. And also, more recently, in the internet epoch, you don't have to go into behind the swishy curtains of a Soho porn shop to see the most explicit imagery because it's only one click away. And I'm not sure what effect that has, but I think it is intrusive and difficult. I mean, I'm not a prude. I don't think one can't show the erotic in any way, but I just don't want to destroy the erotic through brutalized, emotionless, monetarized versions of it.
An image we've got used to in radio, but I still find it somehow miraculous, is the picture of sound, as you describe it. You know, the digital shapes that particular sounds and voices make on a screen, and every human voice, of course, distinct, and it's often quite beautiful to look at, whatever about editing it. I suppose this is part of what's extraordinary in this whole vast area of images and imaging, that we're constantly seeing new things in new ways, and how we see and what we see are constantly made new.
I think, yeah, there are those two things in the book that touch on that, that we're the first generation to see a fetus before it's born through an ultrasound in the hospital. We actually see this thing before life. And in a very different area, in sound production, we actually see sound, which has a very productive effect for new generations that are using their version of the software to mix it.
One detail in the book that stopped me in my tracks was your description of the House of Blind Girls in Caracas in Venezuela. You made a documentary there and met some remarkable people, including Yeni Sanchez, who was blinded by a stray bullet at the age of 9. Tell me a little bit about her and about that experience.
I'd been taken to make a short film by Eamon O'Donoghue, who's an ophthalmologist in Galway Hospital. And he had arranged for us to visit a blind school in Caracas, and a school for blind girls. It had been run by nuns, and they kept a cabinet full of baskets and pottery as an example of what the school was not anymore, because they'd found a way to empower these girls to develop and live without dependence on sight. And at one point, I was pausing and having a glass of water in the corner, and Eamon said to me, "You're right." And I was actually on the verge of tears because I was so humbled by the resilience and the clarity of these young girls in the blind school. And one that particularly touched me was a young girl, Yeni Sanchez, who you mentioned, who had grown up in the barrio, you know, the poor along the hillsides of Caracas. And she just, sad to say, caught a stray bullet, which had severed an optic nerve. And she said she was totally, initially, she was totally devastated to lose her sight from one moment to the next. But then when I said, you know, tell me about your world, she replied, "Many people only judge by appearances, but because we're blind, we're guided by our feelings." And I was so moved by that, that even in a situation of a young girl on the threshold of life losing a faculty like sight, she actually had found ways of saying, well, actually, even this desperate situation has a strength and an advantage. And I you'd have to see the 20,000 Years of Blindness about the girls, that you know, that there is no sense that they are victims or that they are asking for charity. They are actually telling us how we should think about things in different ways.
A striking quote you use in the book, "Blessed are those who possess," and this is around conspicuous consumption and the displaying or flaunting of what we have. We are what we have. I suppose we saw a lot of that here through the Celtic Tiger years, the 1,000 euro handbags and the most expensive car and the perfect home. Do you think we're any less immune to that kind of image-led consumption in the wake of the economic crash and these years of recession and hardship for so many?
No, actually. I mean, we're coming up to Christmas, and the deluge of what we should do, how we should spend our Christmas, is entirely about buying and possessing. Premature obsolescence of everything is replicated and predominant. you know, call me old-fashioned, but the notion of spending a little bit of time in a different space, eating, maybe drinking, talking with mothers, brothers, sisters, children, grandmas, that's what Christmas is. And actually, I think most people probably get through to it. But in front of that is a barrage of pressure about buying stuff. Now, OK, the recession means that not everyone's got the same level of money, but the system is not dependent on the amount you have to spend. And even when it was at its height, you know, there seemed to be no issue about ridiculous levels of wealth. And actually, a lot of the perpetrators seem still to inhabit that world. I actually looked at a strange website yesterday. I'd recommend it. It's called Private Islands. And, you know, there are islands available for, you know, $250,000 in some places. And this fantasy world that somehow we should all aspire to, actually, it hasn't gone away, you know. I mean, I went to Luton Airport and I gave up at about 30, but there were huge numbers of Learjets on the tarmac. You know, the super wealthy are still in their form of possession, and different levels of society inhabit other ways. But there are not so many spaces outside of the absolute possession of things, the absolute focus on owning and possessing things somehow.
I know that the focus of the book is not Ireland, and in many ways that's a relief. But I wonder, you know, from your time with the Film Board and the Houston School and your observation of life and society here, how do you think the power of the visual image has changed and developed in Ireland in, say, the past 20 years? I suppose some of the dominant images remain, and they're deeply commercial, like Pint of Guinness being elevated to almost mythical national status. But it strikes me that maybe the journey in television images from Glen Rowe to Love Hate must mirror something of a shift, you know, this rural-urban shift and a kind of perception of national identity and reality through a completely different lens.
Well, I mean, the first thing that I noticed quite quickly was that despite a shared language, the unsolicited gift of the English language, as Michael D. Higgins put it once, that actually there were some very significant differences in Irish culture. And, you know, the openness and the integration of death as part of life is one rather important one, it seems to be, coming from a country that represses and hides anything to do with death because it's embarrassing. In relation to the visual, I remember making myself a little unpopular with a controversial suggestion that maybe the emphasis of Irish culture is the written, is the musical, because for very clear colonial reasons that, you know, if your domain is the cabin, then you don't have a large wall and many canvases to paint a mural or etchings on. You actually have a space where you can make music, you can tell stories. And so that's where the emphasis from Irish culture emerged when the British retracted. In the epoch since then, I think the visual has come fully forward. You know, Irish artists now compete and, you know, in the Venice Biennale alongside everything else. And indeed, in its more detrimental and unfortunate dimensions, you know, the image system, it's a global image system. So why would Ireland be outside of it? Maybe there are nuances still, those vestiges of a musical and literary culture which are stronger here. But pretty much we're all in the same boat, I think.
And being looked at. Galway's new arthouse cinema, the Picture Palace, set to open next summer. And it already stands out in the city's architecture and skyline, like a piece of sculpture, really, this iconic building and an image that I suspect will find its way into the very medium it contains. A building like this can only be good for the West and for film in the West.
Well, the most extraordinary aspect of all this is the timing, because, you know, 5 years earlier, that would have been a very straightforward operation. But to be able to pull a new cinema together at a moment when public finance is retracted, and philanthropic or commercial finance is also not really there. That is extraordinary.
You've lived with images, made your life or living in and around and with visual images. Is it fair to say that you both love and maybe distrust the image?
Well, that's put much more succinctly than I can. But yes, I guess that the book spends a couple of hundred pages working around the desire, the pleasure, the love, but also the detachment and criticism of the world of images. So there is something of a kind of contradiction, a schizophrenia even, in relation to the image system. One can't pretend to be outside of it. I mean, there is nowhere outside of it.
It's a fascinating book, and we could talk about a great deal more in and around it, but there we leave it. Seeing is Believing, The Politics of the Visual by Rod Stoneman is published by Black Dog Publishing. Rod Stoneman, thanks so much for talking to us.
They're heading due west.
The Wild West! Yeah!
A flavour there of Mike Newell's film Into the West, ending our journey to Galway and the new Picture Palace, among other things. Next week, the music of John Taverner. Join us then, Monday at 10. Till then, good night.